Well, hi there. We'll get started. I'm not mic'd because I need to be mic'd because I have what we call in my profession a union hall voice, so I can normally fill a room this size. My name is John Beck, and I co-direct Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. And for 18 years, Marie was amazed, I think, when I was saying to her this morning that we've been doing it that long. For 18 years, the Scumbag series has tried to look at broadly able to bring art in, because often what we do is much more in the way of labor history or lived experience and other stuff, and art is so key. Let me just make some announcements and then introduce Marie. Next Friday, and I have to tell you that if you do nothing else with your time over the period of the next week, then come to this brown bag next Friday. You have to do it, and I'll tell you why in a second. Now, there are sign-in sheets on the back tables. If you would sign in and send those around, I'll love you all forever. But Candace Taylor is coming back to our series to talk about beauty shop culture and the labor of hairdressing. Now, Candace is currently an Archie Green Scholar at the Library of Congress. She's an unbelievable anthropologist, folklorist, and multimedia ethnographer, she calls herself. Last time she was here, she was doing a program on career diner waitresses. And frankly, it was one of the best single presentations we've had in this series. It just knocked everybody's socks off. So her new thing is beauty shops, okay? So please take one of those and pass it on. The week after, Brandon Ward's coming up from Purdue to talk about confronting the chrome-plated wasteland, the UAW working-class environmentalism and urban crisis in Detroit. So feel free to come back for that. And fresh off the press, the brand new spring semester brown bag list. So this is perfect for putting on the refrigerator and reminding yourself and putting them in your calendar now so you know exactly when those are coming. Okay, two other quick announcements and then the introduction. Next week, actually I think even earlier than next weekend, starts the East Lansing Film Festival. And we are co-sponsoring one film in the East Lansing Film Festival this year, a film on the photographer Milton Rogovin, very famous photographer of the 1960s, 70s today. He recently died at the age of 101. But Rogovin is an interesting man who did a variety of photographic studies of black churches and black church congregations in Buffalo and elsewhere. Buffalo is where he lived. Steel workers both at work and at home, variety of things. But I'll pass this around and you can take down the info. Basically, we're doing a free film showing in these film festivals. Perfectly good money. Free 2 p.m. over in Wells Hall. So feel free to come to that. And I just have to announce that right after that weekend, the following Wednesday, we have a wonderful poet coming to town that we're co-sponsoring at the Residential College in Arts and Humanities. And that's Barbara Pennell, who wrote a book called Piecework that's a kind of a poetic exploration of life in a textile mill, and it's a fabulous book of poetry. It's really quite something. And so she's going to be at the Residential College for a couple of weeks, exhibit that's open on women in textile over in the Lookup starting in November, November 4th, Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Residential College. Brings us to today. I met Marie when we both had a U.S. Department grants to Africa. So when we were at a conference in relation to that, we started talking and we end up talking about Winslow Homer. And Winslow Homer is specifically in regards to his work on women and work. Now I first said that in relation to this cover, which came out on Labor's Heritage magazine, a magazine no longer in publication. But this is the same one he's got up, which is his painting, The Morning Bell. Really about women listening to the fact beyond the women.
Thank you. It's delightful to be here in Michigan. And last night when I was driving from Ohio into the state of Michigan, suddenly as I made that turn, the color was enormously, beautifully autumn brilliance, orange and yellows, and they just popped out. And it reminded me of an image of that Winslow Homer did called Autumn. And I will show that at the end as sort of mentioning it here, but we'll wander through a variety of ways that Homer imaged women, and there are hundreds of examples. And then we'll close with that beautiful image of Autumn. And if you're not here by then, you can look at it on the web. Please do that, Autumn. It's a beautiful piece. So Winslow Homer, Beyond the Morning Bell, Women in and Work in the Work of Winslow Homer. Homer has given us hundreds of images of women, of females. We see little girls, we see adolescent young girls, we see precocious, sexually aware farm maidens. We see young mothers, we see school teachers. We see people on the shore mending the nets and waiting for the fishermen. We see them gathering shells. And we especially see them in the urban environment. So we're going to look first at Winslow Homer and identify the old mill, the morning bell. So for many years, when people began to look at images by Winslow Homer, innocence, purity, all that America was supposed to represent, the Puritanism, they found in Homer's work. But then historians, scholars, researchers began to see recurring themes. Homer is talking about historical events, cultural change, environmental issues. And those only came out in about the last 20 or 25 years as we begin to look a little bit deeper into the life and legend and the images that Homer has given us. So for many years, we might have thought, well, that's the morning bell. It's ringing to call the children, the teachers, everyone to a day's labor in the classroom. But not so, not so. The morning bell is calling these women, primarily, into the textile mills to work. And they were long and gruesome hours. They were there from sun up to no sun on many, many occasions. Most of the images that Winslow Homer gives us are white women, but we do see some elegantly beautiful, poignant images of black women in the fields in Virginia. And we'll see those in just a minute. An image of the school teacher, and of course, being a nurse or a school teacher in the 19th century, very acceptable, respectable images of occupations and images of women. And Homer gives us a full gamut of women working. Most of those are very legitimate, very respectable. But Homer takes us just underneath the level of respectability sometimes to what's called the demi-monde, the half-world, where these women could move easily from one level of respectability to another. And if we look very carefully at Homer's images, we need to ask ourselves, what really is he telling us? We can look at some of the later images from the Adirondacks, for example, and we know clearly that Homer is thinking about the waste of the land and what we are doing to the land that surrounds us and what is it going to look like for the next generation. Looking at those images have caused us to look back at some of the very early images to say, if that was what he was focused on then, telling a second and a third and a fourth richly labeled story, what is he telling us about the urban environment? What is he telling us about the schoolroom or the old mill? If you look at the groups of children, they're all sort of preoccupied in their own space. And if you look at this woman who's employed in her daily life and her daily work as an educator, she looks like she's somewhat removed from the situation, from the scene. She's glancing maybe not specifically at a child, but perhaps letting her gaze wander to the beautiful environment outside. And that beautiful environment that we see in Homer's work are what a lot of people remember and recognize Homer for. They recognize the beauty of the ocean, the sea that he painted many, many times from Prout's Neck, the Adirondacks, the Mink Pond, the elegance of the environment. But few recognize the story that he's telling in these images of the females. Another wistful looking woman as she is standing in front of a blackboard. Another woman at work in the daily occupation of being in the classroom. We've looked at the images, and a mathematician has also looked at those to see what might be the underlying story in those images that are in the background. And we don't have anything conclusive on that yet, but a number of mathematicians have had a shot at it to see what might be the next level of story. Just like the Egyptians who used one image to represent 100 different things, Homer tends to do that as well. There's a surface image and then multiple chapters of his story that lie beneath that. So women worked not only in the urban environment where we're going to spend the majority of our time, but they worked in the country school rooms, they worked in the mills, and they worked on the farms. They were the ones who really orchestrated what happened in the course of the day, taking care of everything internally, while the men were taking care of everything beyond the farm. And even those were the ones who carried the goods and the produce to the cities for bartering or for trading or for selling. So the dinner horn, the woman is calling in the individuals from the country. I've included two in this collection from Michigan. This one happens to be in the Detroit Institute of Art, and the other one is from Muskegon. And this is the one I was referring to earlier, some of the images of Black American women that Homer depicts with poignancy and beauty. It's a grandeur that we see in these images of women. They're clearly at work. And this is a group of people who really did work from sun up to no sun, many, many long hours in the field, pulling cotton. And many times you can look beyond the figures that are there just to let the mind embrace the beauty of the landscape that Homer gives us. And clearly here, another opportunity to look at women working together. A visit from the old mistress, the woman on the right, dating from 1876, and this one is the National Museum of American Art at the Smithsonian in Washington. And the groups of women that we see gathered on the left, a child and little children down here in the shadow, and the conversation, or at least at this moment that Homer has captured for us, this moment of understanding. It doesn't seem to be any conversation going on, but a pause in a day's conversation, time to really absorb what the other one is saying, time to appreciate the presence of the other one, time to recognize roles, time to really embrace the moment. One writer identified as Homer as a realist who embraces the moment. And we see that in these images, and we'll see that in flashes of time as we move into the urban environment and look at a very different collection of individuals. Homer spent some time in England. He spent some time on the coast in the northeast, eventually settling at Prout's Neck in Maine. And many identify a grandeur in those images, especially the ones from England, that might not have been in his work prior to his trip to England. It's infused with almost the freshness of the air that surrounds these individuals on the beach, but they are working women as well. They are collecting maybe the shells, but more likely the mussels or the crustaceans to take home. They might be waiting for the boats. Homer was absorbed by the water and by the sea air and wanted to end up settling in a space there. His home at Prout's Neck sits on a cliff, and from that space you can look out over the broad Atlantic. And as soon as you go up to the area where his studio is, the fir trees are so rich and so abundant that the air changes. And it must have been a place of comfort for Homer, who probably found more refreshment there than he did living and working in the city. You know, Homer started as an illustrator. Homer came into the world of art as an illustrator working in the city, and it was right about the same time. His timing could not have been better for an artist wanting to move from illustration to painting. Newspapers changed from those long columns with no illustrations to beginning to use illustrations to share the story or to tell the news. And he was hired to do much of that. He didn't really enjoy it. At least that's what he tells us in his literature, his writings. And there's very few pieces of information that Homer shares with us. And he often said, "The most interesting part of my life is of no interest to you anyway. Just enjoy my work and take from that what you will." Some historians have tried to connect him romantically with a Helena de Kay, a young woman with red hair who we see often in her work. But be that as it may, he was interested in a much broader realm of what he could capture and record, probably for future generations. And when we look at the images that he was telling us about in the Adirondacks and in the woods of New York, where people were cutting down trees and clearing the land with really no sense, he was giving us a message. He's doing the same thing in the city and in the images of the working women. He's telling us much more than we see when we first look at the painting. He's inviting us. He's asking us, "Wait, don't go away just yet. Take another look. What really do you see? Look at the color. Let your mind and your heart and your eyes absorb what he's showing you in the color, and particularly in the relationship. Who is this person looking at? What kind of communication has just happened, as we saw with the visit from the old mistress? Is conversation about to happen? What is the story that lies behind much of what Homer is telling us?" So the relationships, the personal story, is really not as important. For some, it's quite interesting. But we need to look beyond that personal life that he led, which he didn't want us to know much about, which is probably the reason it intrigues so many people, and look at what he has given us. He's given us much more stories than we could possibly unpack or unfold or turn the page in a chapter book to discover what's there. I can't imagine what people will find in 10 or 20 more years of research as we continue to research Homer. Listening to the voice from the cliffs. So it's not only the voices that we share with one another, but the voices that we share with nature. He's so in tune to his environment that he's pulling the sounds out of the surroundings. He does that beautifully in the city. His work is affected by wind and rain, and we'll see that in several images. He moves the viewer, you and you and you and me, into a different realm and invites us to step onto the shore of Teignmouth, or to step onto the shore of Mink Pond, or to step onto the corner of Boston Street. and mending the nets, a necessary occupation. These women, part of their daily lives, their daily work, was mending the nets and getting everything ready for the fishermen to go out. With the nets not mended correctly, the fish that they caught would slip away. So these women had a very important job in the life of any fishing community, any fishing industry. And Homer, if you noticed in the story or the picture, it is a story, the picture of the women picking cotton, he elevates the least appreciated job to a very high level of grandeur. So he's taking these women who maybe are only doing this for pittance or only because they live in a community where this is what they are assigned to do in the fishing community and it's part of the bigger picture. But he elevates the least important job to the most important place. Almost as if he's studied Greek art. And probably he did. The beauty and grandeur that we see in the 5th century is represented in Homer's work. And this one is signed by the painter. So he calls himself a painter. Winslow Homer, painter. Improve the present hour. And it is an etching, and it dates fairly late in his career, 1889. Homer was born in 1836 and died in 1910. And he painted almost all the way through to the very end of his life. The gale. Again, we see the effects of nature, the effects of the wind, the effects of the rain and the push. But here, the young mother, that's her job. She is taking care of a child, and it may not be her child. We do know that a lot of the images were images of women who were tending the children. But here, the young woman with the reddish hair looks very much like she is the natural mother of the child that she carries on her back. And now, this time, look where the communication is. The child is talking to you. The child is saying, "Whoo, isn't this fun?" And the mother is bracing herself against the storm. The child's eyes, if you can see them, are looking at you. Homer finds a way to pull us into the story. Each painting, each illustration, each drawing has something there that will tug at you to make you want to linger just a little bit more, stay more involved and more in tune. It's there. There are many images that he has done of the shore and the rising of the gale in the background. The Toledo Museum of Art in Toledo, Ohio, which is very near the University of Findlay, has a very large picture, and it's very similar to this, but the images of the humans that occupy many of his paintings almost until the very last decade of his life are not there. It's clearly the beauty of the surroundings, the beauty of the sea, and the push of the air that you can almost sense as you walk into the gallery. We're moving into another area of the rural life as we look at the return of the gleaner from the field. The gleaner is someone who goes in after the harvest and gleans what's left. There are wonderful stories that the French did in the 19th century. Of the gleaners. This one is at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville, and you may have read about this. It was established by Alice Walton in Arkansas, and there a lot of press has been covering all of the great images that she has there that people in New York are saying they should stay in New York. And her argument is, no, they need to come where everyone can enjoy and see art. Not a reproduction of art, but the real thing. A student in the Toledo Museum one time was standing in front of a Rembrandt, and the student said, "Well, this is nice, but where's the real thing?" And I said, "This is it." "No, this can't be it." She said, "I could touch it." And I said, "But please don't." She said, this can't be the real thing. It is the real thing. The real thing speaks a different language when you're looking at it, because when you're looking at a picture in a book, you don't know the size. The color may have been distorted. Only when you're standing in front of an image can you truly appreciate its value and the story that it has to tell. So while this is a fairly good reproduction for a slide, it doesn't give you the intensity or the emotionality that a color in its presence could. We're going to move very gently into the urban environment, and you're saying, how can that happen? We've just heard the sound of the bell, we've just looked at the morning bell, and now we're moving into a new field, and you keep talking about the urban environment. Where is it? It's coming. But a veteran in a new field, and we do know that Homer titled many of his works. So if we look at the date, 1865, and we have a title that says Veteran in a New Field, the door is open for possibilities of what is he talking about. We've already know that by eight, we've studied his work, and so we already know by 1865, he's telling us many, 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 many stories. So the veteran in a new field, certainly this deals with the Civil War. And a field that maybe months ago was littered with dead. But now this is a veteran in a new field. And in the original, you can see on the side his hat that he wore in the service. So we're still in the rural environment. And now, please look at the background of this. If your mind can take the veteran out of his field for just a minute and absorb the beauty, the richness of that color in the background. A colleague of Homer's one time said, I bet you can't paint a painting that's just all browns. And he said, I bet I can. And he did, and I'm going to show you that one, but this is on its way to being there. So our watering places, the empty sleeve at Newport, gradually is getting us into a space where the urban environment is going to have a bigger scene. So we've just come from the veteran in a new field. And we reflected for just a minute on the Civil War. So this is August of 1865. And prior to the war, very unlikely for that woman to be at the reins. But now her husband is a victim. He's been wounded in the war. The empty sleeve is there. And so women's lives are changing. Women are forced to be more involved in the urban environment, more involved in daily work that takes them out of the interior protected space of the schoolroom, of their home in the country, of their home in the city, and it puts them in a very different place. And this was in Harper's Weekly. You'll see Harper's Weekly a lot. Harper's Weekly, Harper's Bazaar, and several other, Appleton's Journal, that Homer was a continual contributor for. So here we're revisiting the bell again, just so that we can get reconnected with this idea of the contextual environment here. We're looking at a woman going into the labor mills. And now I want you to look particularly at this collection of women on the right. They're engaged in conversation. Who are they talking about? What are they talking about? Why isn't she involved in the conversation? It looks like there's a disconnect between this woman who's crossing the bridge and going to work. So what is the rest of the story? Yes, women worked in those mills, we know that, and they worked long and hard hours, and it was tedious and probably hateful and little pay. So So we're going to focus here on this collection of women here for just a minute. If you can just absorb that, then we're going to move on. And as your eye goes there, let it go to the building in the background, which could very well be a real school. So maybe there's the morning bell as well. But here, most likely, a textile. And the color that he uses in the foreground and in the background in the original is truly beautiful. It absorbs you. He's a colorist, I think we could call him. So here we have New England factory life, bell time. And look very carefully at the collection of people that Homer has given us. So I'll let your eyes ride that wave of people for just a minute. You see conversations happening. You see quiet conversations where there really isn't any dialogue happening. But you see something really significant going on right here with these three individuals. And if you can see the woman in the middle, the gentleman on the right, on your right, and this woman here, and then the eye is caught by this woman here. So what's happening here? It looks like there's something transpiring. But what is it? What is it? So it took a little bit of research to determine, this is what's happening here. Let me tell you before we move there that this period of industrialization brought a lot of people into the urban environment. One writer said it was a time of fast men and loose women. Well, it was a time when the city attracted a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. And the city was not always the greatest of gifts to everybody that was attracted there. Some had to work very long and hard for a pittance. Some, of course, the Vanderbilts, the Whitneys, the Rockefellers, and others glided through the sudden change in the industrial environment, the urban environment. It began to have a cosmopolitan look to it. So when we begin to study a little bit about the sexual dynamics, the socio-sexual dynamics of the culture, we begin to understand that the woman in the middle here, this woman with her finger pointed, and her finger is pointing to this young girl right here. It could be, in fact, pointing to this woman over here. She is identified as a procuress, and a procuress is someone who gets women for pay for this gentleman here. That's her job. French artist Dick depicted that. Degas did a lot of images, and a lot of comparisons can be made with some of his early images. Manet gives that to us as well in the 19th century. So these three right here, the procuress, the woman she's getting ready to sell, and the gentleman who's getting ready to buy her for the evening. Or it could be that one over there. That's the dialogue, that's the communication, that's the conversation that's happening. And we see it again, and again, and again. And the research is solid. The diaries, the literature from the period identifies this woman, not particularly this woman, but women who worked as procuresses to enhance the trade of prostitution. And talking to these two men, but where's the young woman? She's here. Can you see her on the far left? She's right here. And she's looking over here, trying to decide what's happening. She's not a stranger that's passing by who doesn't know what's happening. The procuress has her there. So the woman is actively engaged in her daily life, which is working in the world of prostitution. It's illegitimate at the time, illegal, and it's something that attracted women because they were often driven there without any other resources for their daily lives. They sometimes worked in millinery shops, sewing on ribbons and bows and buttons for very little money. And this was a period of time when a lot of women were engaged in what's called sartorial worship. They loved clothes, elegant clothes. And everyone, a lot of women, would sacrifice a lot of things to get these garments, even the factory workers who would work long and hard. One of the images that was the tip-off for what is happening in much of the urban environment is this scene by Homer. It dates early on in his career, 1857, but even then, after looking at some of the images that are dated later than this, we are just almost charged to go back to those early images and say, okay, if this is happening in 1865 and 1868, what was he telling us in 1857 that we missed the first time through? If you're looking at his images as a chronological study, it's important to go back continually to what he did in the very beginning. So we have a street scene, an intersection at a corner of Winter Washington and Summer Streets, a wood engraving from Bellow's Pictorial Drawing Room Companion, dating from 1857. It identifies a geographic place. It identifies the push and the charge of the changing environment. And right in the center of the composition is a young woman. We have all classes of people identified here. And we also have some one individual who's surveying the entire thing, almost as if he's the artist. He's looking, taking it in. He's not reacting to what's going on in the scene. He's just a voyeur, sort of. He's the tall man with the top hat. So we have the tall man in the top hat and the organ grinder and the little girl and the monkey and all kinds of things happening in the environment, in the urban environment. And much could be taken out of this and taken away for the story. And then when we look at the images, not only do we need to look at the images, but we need to look at the words that Homer uses. The last scene, he identified an exact space for us, Jones Company, and an exact spot. He may have changed a little of the what was happening at that moment, but those are recognizable places. He didn't really change what was there. Here, he has given us spring in the city, and on top of this storefront, he has identified laces and fancy goods, right above these pictures of the women. So he's telling us, maybe he's making a play on words, on their interest in fashion, and that's what their primary interest might have been. And we see a lot of women promenading, walking the streets, of all classes. And that's why the lines are so blurred during this period in the 19th century. It's difficult to tell, and nobody needed to really know, apparently, the courtesans, the very high-class courtesans, from the others, the wealthy who were in the streets. So looking at it again, laces and fancy goods with the women in the spring. Most of the places in New York had two times of the year when they drew the women in, the spring and the fall, and that was when the stores encouraged women to come in with maybe a little wine, a little something to nibble, and they would try to sell their wares. So the more wine they poured, they were hoping the more the pocketbooks would be open and the more the ladies would purchase things. For example, in this one, opening day in New York. So we're going to look carefully at this, and it dates from 1868. By 1868, Homer was well aware of what was happening in these newly changing urban environments. He was very aware of all the classes who were coming together. He was aware of different occupations, of different daily work activities that were happening by a large number of people, men and women. And what we have here, women looking at parasols over here, and a cloakroom, which we really don't see anywhere anymore, on the left where people hang their coats when they come in. And above, a large collection of women looking and perhaps making decisions about what to buy. You see the words that are right underneath that in the very center of the composition? Artificial flowers. So what is he telling us here? These are women who are trying to be fashionable, and they're not really, so they're just artificial flowers. There has to be something more to that, those two words. Of all the things that he could have put there, why that? Why didn't he put the name of the store? Why is he telling us artificial flowers? So a little more research into the terminology of the period gives us this. Related to the theme of artificial flowers are several activities common to 19th century brothels. Perhaps one of the most visible was the appearance of young girls who peddled artificial flowers at all hours of the days and night, frequenting saloons and houses of ill repute. And that's from McCabe in Lights and Shadows of New York Life, where a lot of that's primary evidence, a lot of that information is coming from. He described the flower girls as hideous little creatures whose wares are beautiful and command a ready sale, and men are irresistibly drawn to them by the sight of their exquisite ornaments. Observed one journalist, the peddler of posies all too often became the ladies of the camellias. And that's a term that we see in a lot of the French art of Manet and also Degas, the soiled camellia. During the middle decades of the 19th century, there was a growing demand for young female prostitutes, such as the flower vendors. One of the primary reasons was related to a popular belief circulating among the male populace during the second half of the century that sexual intercourse with the virgin cured venereal diseases. Brothels offered the service of a virgin prostitute for their customers willing to pay the extra money. To continually accommodate their customers, these young girls were taught ways to simulate being a virgin. So he's telling us much more. I looked at this image 100 times until I began to look at artificial flowers. What does that have to do with anything? So the second layer of information, and probably a third and a fourth, leads us to these very profitable, she's probably, could be, the head of a very exclusive brothel in the city of New York or Boston, and I will show you one in just a second. But there's a close-up of artificial flowers. So there's a message that he's telling us. There is a place in New York, and I kept using the same research, and my advisor at Bowling Green State University said, I'm not buying this at all. It's a great story, but I'm not buying it. Where's the primary evidence? One night, very late in the library, was about to close, I pulled one last book off the shelf, and in that document, it described almost exactly the images that Homer was giving us, even to the decoration within the drawing room where the women were gathered. There are seven women, and usually the women who worked in the brothels had a man who lived in the house to take care of them, to fix the house, to tend to the things that needed to take place, to protect them. And we often see those women in the country, at the shore, at the racetrack, and there's the gentleman who's generally we see in these images of Homer. And while we look at this and say the straw ride, well, that's nice. It's a day in the autumn and we get in the wagon and we're riding around enjoying the day. But there's more. This is an afternoon's entertainment for these women away from their daily work or nightly work. They went to the racetracks, and there we see a collection of women, again, with the young man or the man in the center. The watering places, particularly Saratoga and other places, were well-known resorts and attracted a lot of people. And you have to know, too, that the courtesans of the city were quite wealthy, and they could live a very high life, lived in the great mansions next door to the Vanderbilts, the brownstones. You couldn't really tell the difference. They also frequented the country, and one scholar suggests that perhaps the women on the right are not part of any courtesan establishment, but the women on the left, what shall we do next, are there. It's just another image to show you of the women. Now this is the one. Waiting for calls on New Year's Day. And this is the one that was that sealed the story for my advisor. She said, okay, you've got it. I agree. So this is a place that's open on New Year's Day, as a lot of houses were. And it was a tradition that the men went from one house to another to visit families or others. And the brothels carried on that same tradition. So these women at the house of Josie Woods are waiting for their callers on New Year's Day. Perfectly innocent title because it fits with the culture. Homer doesn't depart too much from the reality of the culture. He cloaks what he's telling us of this secondary world into the reality of the real world. And you just have to flip the pages a couple of more times to figure out what he's really telling us. So all of these women gathered together waiting for calls on New Year's Day. The woman in the middle may be checking off the names. Men could not just come to the door. Men had to give a card and it was examined, and then they were given the permission or scheduled a time. The information in the articles that we've read identify spaces just like this. The velvet chair, the chairs that are used here, the statue in the background, very discreet statue with the cloak drawn around her as if to say, shh, what goes on here is private. And then towards the end, of course, of life in the city and the urban environment, we've had a chance to look very briefly at Homer as he's moved us through images of those young girls. The young mother on the beach, remember the woman with the red hair and the little boy on her back. Women at the shore gathering, mending the nets, getting ready for the sailors to come home. We've seen them in the fields, the cotton fields. We've seen them taking care of the house and coordinating the things that happen in the big house with the houses that surround that on a plantation, as we saw with the visit from the old mistress. We've seen images from the urban environment that take us from one point to another within the space. And we moved into the world of slightly the demi-monde as we looked at the women in the factory and also what happened outside the factory on the way into it as they were being procured for another line of work to get money to feed their children. And many times it was desperation. Many of the women worked in millinery shops, and that's another whole lecture, the women and the hat industry. But at the end of the day, women found companionship in each other, the quietness of a walk on the beach. And again, it's the beauty of Homer that absorbs us, not only in the clothes the women are wearing, the multiple layers of silks and brocades, but also the grandeur of the space that spills out behind the two women. And this is the one who a colleague of Homer said, I bet you can't paint a picture that's all in brown. I can, and that's pretty much it. But isn't it beautiful? Again, the wind has its effect on the woman as she's just breathing in. It actually looks very much like the area around Homer's home, his studio and home in Prout's Neck. The west wind. And where is my autumn? Let me try. My autumn isn't here. She is, I don't know where she is. She's probably on my flash drive. I'm sorry she's not on this one. But she is lovely, and again, it is a woman surrounded by the out of doors and surrounded by nature, and she's truly beautiful. As you all have been this afternoon, giving me an opportunity to revisit Homer, to get back into the literature. I'm working on a piece that will be ready for publication in about a year, and the topic will be Winslow Homer and the Demimonde. Winslow Homer, their daily work, their daily lives, as it occurs slightly below the level of what some would call respectability, but working women, nevertheless. Thank you.
Well, I've got a number of questions, and you probably have a number of questions and comments as well, so let's just open it up, and who would like to start? Anybody want to bid in with a question or a comment? Sure.
I was just lucky enough to be reading Walker Evans and James Agee's Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. And there's a short episode in there of three black men. This is in 1938. Three black men who are stopped by Walker Evans and James Agee as they're interviewing these three tenant families whom they hope to write about for Fortune magazine. And the depiction of these three men is so like the expressions on the faces of the African American women in The Visit, Mistress. And Evans and Angie's description of their feelings about the discomfort of a racial tension between these two groups, because neither the black men nor the white men, or the black women, or the white woman, knew exactly what their place was. Mm-hmm. And whereas you were talking about this as maybe a visit for old times, a look back, I saw a lot more racial tension in there, a lot more discomfort.
Yes, of course, that's an excellent comment, excellent observation. And sometimes we are driven by what we expect to see there. We expect to see that kind of consternation or tension between the two different cultures. And we're asked by Homer to look beyond that. Of course, these are two women who are visiting one another. The old woman certainly has the power card, as she controls what happens with those around her. But particularly the woman that was directly in front of her, there must have been, we would hope, in the gentleness, and I do agree there is that element of tension there, but understanding from woman to woman, this is what I'm charged to do. I need to make sure things are running smoothly. And also the protection that other woman, the black woman, needs to make sure is happening, because behind her are generations. There's maybe her daughter, and then there were children there too. So her stance is, I need to make sure that my child doesn't get sold into slavery, or that you don't snatch my baby away. And the woman is there to say, I understand, but this is my job too. So that's an excellent point. They're coming together to meet each other, to take care of business. Very good observation.
Well, if you don't mind a minute, I was struck by the same thing. There's a famous strike painting, you know, the same era by Kohler in Wisconsin. It has this mass of men shaking their fists and whatever at the boss. And the boss is in a perfect top hat, is standing on the office stairs, front stoop of his office, and you can see the paper mill in the background. But he's standing, you know, absolutely straight rigid. And the mistress is very, very straight rigid in this. And I mean, given the time of it, I mean, either it's a mistress who is encountering former slaves, or a mistress who is encountering sharecroppers who still might work on the plate, or it's actually historic, looking at a mistress encountering real slaves. It depends on how you play it, but I was struck by the relationship between the two, and especially the notion of the old mistress, that is, by its very nature, it's a different class of women, it's a different, they do have a different kind of relationship. And I was struck by it. I mean, they very well may still have simpatico. They still very well may mm-hmm. have kind of an understanding relationship, but it very well may be that it's still very stratified in relation to role and responsibility mm-hmm. and everything else. It just came across that way mm-hmm. to me in that painting.
But and it fits with the idea of work again. They both have a job to do.
Right. And mistresses within plantations often still work side by side mm-hmm. with their slaves mm-hmm. or whatever. So, I mean, it very well may be that these are both working women, but I was just struck by, mm-hmm. There's a very famous painting from South Africa called I'm Sorry, Madam, and it shows a domestic worker. You don't see the madam in the painting. She is a shadow on the wall, and yet the woman is looking down, mm-hmm. very much downcast, is apologizing to a woman who is absent from mm-hmm. the painting. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most powerful paintings in South Africa by Manager Kemba from that era. Great. Other questions or comments?
Yes.
Sure.
Did Harper's Weekly and Harper's Magazine know what was going on?
Oh, probably not.
I was going to say, I can't imagine.
No, probably not. If they knew, there would be something about it written somewhere, or they, you know, there were probably lots of images that moved beyond what they were trying to portray as a magazine for the family. The Harper's Weekly telling things that were going on. In the back pages of some of those, there's even a gossip column, and it identified who's going where, and I mean, there were inferences that could have been taken from that, but I doubt if the editors really knew what was happening.
So what you're really arguing, to a great degree, is that Homer is very self-aware ironic. That is, that he's playing out many of these images as ironic images, like the artificial flowers issue or other things. I guess let me get you to the one at Saratoga. Mm. Do we know, for example, whether or not horse races, whether or not there would have been a mixture of working women, in that case prostitutes, as well as wives at Saratoga, or was it a male-dominant kind of space where you were less likely to actually see spouses in that space?
No, that women were, at Saratoga and Newport and others, women and men were both there.
Right, but you're arguing that many of the women that are there that, again, from an ironic point of view, that anyone looking at it could believe that these are wives, but instead, in reality, these are working women, not necessarily wives.
That's correct. And that group of seven women wouldn't be with three or four men. There would be that one gentleman with them. So a husband and wife would likely be seated together, and then we have this little collection of women.
And because of women's proper place in that time, large groups of women would not be going off alone to Saratoga, would be the argument.
Probably, yeah. And this same group of women would promenade. So there are a number of promenade scenes of them going down the sidewalks. And they're always with this gentleman, the gentleman who protects them. He's usually in front, sometimes he's in back, but you see the seven or eight women in their finery, and they would wear finery that was of one sort at 10 in the morning, another at 2 in the afternoon, and another in the evening. So your next talk about the textile is very interesting. I might come back up for that. Great questions. Good observations, all.
This is a wonderful program.
Thank you.
Other questions? Because let me raise the one about the two. It's interesting. Let's put the two side by side. On the one side, you had the morning bell, and on the other time, you had bell time. Those are very different images of women in textile. So in the one case, you have them in a small group of the one crossing the bridge, and the other, these are the Lowell mills.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the day.
At the end of shift, so people are leaving. And in the one case, you have a lot of child laborers in the center.
Yeah, right in the center.
Also, loom thread boys and whatever mm-hmm. that are being done. I think the one woman that you point to, I mean, and again, I'm not totally buying Demimonde in relation to that, in terms of curious, but
yeah.
It won't maybe the case. But she looks absolutely exhausted. I mean, the young woman, the other one
if you take the crone notion, here's a woman who's probably in her late 50s, early 60s in that painting, and meaning that she's either been working at it a long time or has been forced back into the factory. A lot of women had to go into work, including prostitution, just because of death of spouse or
the war.
Or whatever kinds of reasons. I think it's often been said about the 19th century and other centuries as well, that women were always just one step away from prostitution, just because of the fact that if there was any upending of their lives, that there wasn't a lot that they could do indeed to keep food on the table, because many of the occupations that they would do otherwise would be very lowly paid.
Millinery was one of them, and the millinery shops did attract a lot of women to work there, but the problem was that unless they owned the shop, they were getting paid very, very little and often were forced into prostitution. And for a while in the 19th century, by about the 1860 or 1870, we see millinery shops everywhere, but prior to that, we would connect in many of the images and in the literature as well. If the hat box itself was an indication or a clue that it was a woman who was available. So it's, you know, the images, the icons, the figures, the way they're placed in the positions and the stories they tell make for a very interesting, and it's never ending, because we learn one thing about the city in 1870 and then not too many years later we find other information about it. For many, many years after Homer's death, people looked at his work through formalist concerns or compositional attitudes, but only recently, as I said at the beginning, have we started to really look at the contextual message that's there. This can't just be out there for pure imagery. Those can't just be terms that were popped out of the imagination and popped in at that particular place. There has to be more to the story. And that invites a deeper investigation into all of his images.
For those of you who know 19th century art, George Innes's Lackawanna Railroad is a very famous piece. It often was the basis of Turner's whole argument in Machine in the Garden. You see this huge green space in this locomotive in the middle of it, right?
Right.
And I think that the morning bell comes out of that notion that it's possible to have industrialization and still be in a pastoral. I mean, that's a very strongly pastoral. Whereas when you get to bell time, this is not, there's no romanticism here at all.
Mm-mm.
I mean, the hard edge of the realism in that case is very much you know, using the black and white of drawing rather than a painting, but also just how beat up and worn out and used up all those workers are. Very different than the morning bell, where you've got a woman who's going to work the looms, but she's very well dressed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that whole image of really being able to have both beauty and industrialization side by side, I think is very, very strong. Other questions or comments from anybody about this? Let's give Marie one more round of applause.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm trying to find the autumn for you. I hope it's on the flash drive. The young woman who was here, her name is Autumn, and I told her I had it. And then, of course, it wasn't here. And there she is. Let me show you. There, Autumn. I'm sorry, Autumn, she had to leave early for volleyball. Yeah. This is the image that came into my head when I came across the line into Michigan and made that turn. The whole bank of that hillside was that color. And I thought, I need to add that. And then she had to leave and I didn't get it I had it on the flash drive, but not on the computer. I will try to find her and send it to her.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. It has been a pleasure to be here. I'm sporting my green and white today in honor of our partnership with Michigan State University. It's been grand. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I look forward to seeing you next week.
Yes.